This is the fourth in a series of interviews on the pioneer families of the Hall District. Today I'm speaking with Mr. Kingsley Southwell, who's a descendant of Mr. Thomas Southwell, who came from England and arrived in Sydney in 1838 and then in 1840 settled on a piece of land along the Ginninderra Creek. G'day Kingsley, how are you?
I'm well, thanks Phil.
Now what can you tell me about Thomas Southwell, who came to Australia from England with his wife Eliza and two children in 1838.
I can tell you what my mother told me and what I've read and what I've learned from other people. Apparently they lived in Robertsbridge in East Sussex in England, and he was a fairly, you know, successful guy with what he was doing with his work. He was a farm labourer, like a lot of them were over there. I don't think he owned any land in England. But he'd heard that, you know, land was available in Australia and people were leaving England in hordes, you know, to get away from the terrible conditions that they lived in over there. And it was actually a question of whether he came to Australia or to America. And he went down to the wharf or whatever, apparently, and he got on the first ship that was leaving, and it happened to be the Lady Nugent, and it came to Australia, came to Sydney in Australia. So he arrived here then, so I think towards the end of 1838. Settled around Cobbity near Camden for a couple of years and sort of established himself a bit. I don't know much about his life there, but he heard that when he was living there that there was good land available and good living conditions on the Ginninderra Creek. So he decided to come and have a look, and he came up here about 1840 sometime with his young family and settled here, decided it was good and decided to stay here. I understand he only worked as a farm labourer for some of the wealthier farmer type people around the place until he put together some money, because he was a very, very careful man with what he did with money and what he believed, and he just was a decent sort of a guy apparently. And he came up in 1840, and then it was some years later before he actually bought some land, but he eventually got some land and built a house, and so it went on.
He was quite a religious man, I understand.
Absolutely. He was a very keen Wesleyan Methodist in England before he left, and when he came out here he preached and believed in the same thing. One of the first things he did after he got land was build a church, of all things. You know, he built his house and the next thing he built was a church, because that's how strong his Christian faith was.
I understand from the information I've read that he built his first place, or he bought his first piece of land in 1854 and called it Parkwood.
Yeah, something like that. The exact date you've obviously got down to a book somewhere. That's fine. And I'm not sure about the name Parkwood. He must have brought it from England. There must be a place in England called Parkwood. Otherwise, where would he get it from? Because it sounds like an English name, doesn't it? It's amazing how a lot of the properties around this area all had wood in their name. I can think of about six or eight properties that were either started with wood or ended with wood. Mm. So, it must be an English term.
Before he was able to buy land, he had some very unfortunate incidents in his life, I suppose you'd call them. In 1852, his wife Eliza died.
Yeah, you can imagine that, living out here in this Australian bush, full of wild men and ticker-to-leave guys and bush rangers and all sorts of types that weren't very pleasant. And here it was, his wife died having their ninth baby. You can imagine it, back then, imagine it. She died from emphysema or something, not emphysema, septicemia. And they kept the baby going for a good few weeks, I think, but it eventually died. So here was this man that had eight young children living on his own in the bush, way out in the middle of nowhere. Life would have been tough. Oh, hell, it would have been tough. Anyway, fortunately, a year or so later, he met a widow, Mary, and he fell in love with her, fortunately. I suppose he needed her and she needed him, because she was a widow with two girls and he was this lady out in the bush with two children on her own. Fortunately, they fell in love and they married, and that was the best thing that could have happened to him. And he went on and had nine more children with her.
That was Mary Croxton,
yeah,
I believe.
Yes.
How do you think, you know, the family survived on the land? I mean, a lot of the farmers failed as selectors. Either they chose the wrong piece of land or the, you know, the drought conditions or whatever. Why was Thomas so successful?
Well, if you think about it, he had all these children. So as soon as the boys especially were old enough, they'd be working. They'd be working with him. And the girls were out working. They'd be looking after the milking cow, or they'd be working in a vegetable garden, or they'd be doing something other to help on. So he had plenty of free labour. And that's, I think, what made him successful. Plus, he was a pretty clever guy, you know, shrewd sort of guy. And, you know, he eventually then started with a bullock team going to Sydney. And he'd take some of it, one of his sons with him half the time. He needed always a second person to do it. And he'd line up somebody to take there, and he'd take them down there, and they'd work on that.
You said he was quite a religious man, and you did mention that the area here was quite, probably a bit like the Wild West, with the bush rangers and the activities. And I think it was Julia Webb, Judy the Great, even commented, and she ran a sly grog shop, she commented that the arrival of Thomas in the area had a great effect on calming down the area and bringing good into the locality.
Absolutely. He was obviously a total teetotaler, and he preached the gospel wherever he went. As I said, he built his own church in about 1860, I believe, and he invited, you know, preachers in from all around the area to come and preach at his church, and he did a lot himself. And apparently, you know, every night in the park at home, they'd have a little service, like a Bible reading or whatever. So he's very sort of strict and all that sort of thing. And that rubbed off in the people in the community. And, yeah, people did respect him for what he stood for. I mean, there was one story apparently where one of these wild sort of guys held him up. And he must have been at home on his own, I think. I'm not 100% of the short story, but, you know, they wanted his money. And he said, I haven't got any, because he'd heard they were around. And so a little bit of money he had, he put it in the bark of the wall of his house, hid it, in other words. Anyway, when these shonky bloke came to take his money, he turned to him and said, I'm not afraid to die, but what's going to happen to you? In other words, he wasn't afraid of that guy. He wasn't afraid. That was his Christian belief, and that's what stuck to him. The guy left. I think Tom was probably frightened the living daylights out of him, which would have been a good thing. He left and he pinched the kid's money box, apparently, and got a couple of bob out of that or something or other. So, yeah, he was a man of standing in the community. And his descendants, well, a lot of them are still the same.
I understand in that incident he was actually tied to a tree and they threatened to shoot him.
Yeah.
Unless he told them where the money was hidden.
That's right.
And he refused to do
it. He refused to tell them.
Yeah.
They tied him up, but eventually he got free, or somebody came and let him free.
He built his first brick home, I understand, in 1860.
63, I think.
Mm.
I think, yeah. It's still there. The Parkwood house is still there.
The original house, homestead.
Yeah. It's been modified quite a bit, but yeah.
And he also gave land up for the church to establish the Weetangaroo Methodist Church?
No.
Is that right?
No. He gave land to the church to build the Parkwood Church.
Parkwood Church.
Which is quite close to his house,
mm-hmm.
where he lived there. It was a 99-year sort of a permanent lease thing or something to the Methodist Church. I don't know how that part of it worked. I mean, it's all worn out. It's all time's up now. But it's still on that property, and it's maintained. It's not used much, but it's maintained. Occasionally they have a wedding there or something. They have open days on Heritage Week and so forth. It's been preserved pretty well.
Right, okay. One of his, just on a slight tangent, his son by Eliza was Tommy. Now, Tommy was a bit of an eccentric character, I understand.
Yeah, Tommy Two Sticks.
That's right.
Yeah. He had these two sticks. Nobody knows what they were. There's all sorts of ideas about it. My mother never knew, and if she would have known, she would have said, but she didn't know. We used to talk about it, and she didn't know. They weren't crutches. They were something like some sort of a sticks, but apparently you could get along on them. Whether they were just like long walking sticks, I don't know. But apparently you could travel as fast as a horse, I reckon. Now, I think he'd knock up pretty quick with anything like that, but yeah, he was always called Tommy Two Sticks.
In 1858, Thomas's brother John arrived from England also with his wife Lucy, and I think they established themselves on an adjoining property, but I'm not sure how long they stayed there.
No, there was apparently four brothers that came out over a period of time. Yeah, John came out. He settled around it, like where Canberra is now, where Lynham and some of that sort of area is, apparently. His descendants are still in that area. And there's another one, Mark, who he didn't have many children from memory. And there was another one, I think his name was William, and he went to the goldfields in Victoria. And we've never heard much about him. I only learned about him a few years ago. I didn't even know he ever existed. But I think he might have even left Australia. I'm not sure.
Right.
But yeah, there was the other two that came here later on, yeah, followed their brother.
So there was quite a few Southwells established in the area by, you know, the late 1860s, 1870s.
Yeah, because this guy had these 20 children, and you know, they all, well, the 19 survived at least. The baby died, that first baby died. The 19 survived, and they had 138 children between them. Right, so my father, think about it, my father is a grandson of Thomas. He's got 137 either brothers and sisters or first cousins, which is a massive family. Now, those 100, they all married sort of thing, and well, about all, with all the 138 married, I suppose they did, but you can imagine, there's thousands of them. They had a centenary in 1938, apparently, at Parkwood, and there's a famous photo there with all the people in it. I don't know how many were there, of course I wasn't there, but we had another one in 1988 at the ANU in Canberra, and there was over 3,000 people at that.
Wow.
And that's just the ones that came. We've got a photo of that that's, you know, there's 3,000, I don't know, 3,000 people in it. How many's in it, I don't know. I think some had left by that time, but yeah. But it's got that big now, it's, you know, it's almost impossible to track down. Some people try and do it, but they get it wrong sometimes.
Thomas died in 1881, and 4 years later his wife Mary died. So that left the children to carry on the tradition of the Southwells in the area. Let's talk about Richard. Now, Richard Southwell, who's your grandfather, settled here at Brooklands.
In 1877. Single man then. I mean, he was only 20-something, 24 or 5 or something. How much he did here in the early days, I don't know. But he got Brooklands here, 220 acres. And he would have built some sort of a house here, I guess. But then he married in 1882. He married Amelia Smith, who was a local girl. And they set up a house here, and he built, you know, a substantial house then at the time. And they had 9 children and lost 3 of them as infants.
What do you remember of Richard and Amelia?
Well, he died before I was born.
Right.
They both died before I was born, so I never met them, so I don't know. I've talked to a cousin of mine there once, who was old enough to remember him. And he said he was quite an interesting character, but he didn't sort of... He was only a child and he didn't have that much memory of it, so... Yeah, they were a long, long way between having children. Like, Richard was 43 when my father was born and my father was 43 when I was born, right. You know, so it's a long time frame. And, yeah, these old people die off before the grandkid knew them. So I don't know, but I know he's a hard-working man. Well, he cleared this land here and set up a farm like this, and he was a pretty respected man in the community, like we said, all the Southwells were. And he used to... One of his things in the winter time was driving this rabbit cart from this Wallaroo area into Queanbeyan Railway Station, where he'd pick up rabbits along the way that the young teenage boys had set traps, and they'd have them hang on the fence all the way along to haul sort of thing, and he'd pick them up and keep a score and all that. Take them into the train, put them on the train, they go to some freezing works in Bungendore or somewhere, and he'd come home again. That's a fair sort of day's work, I'd reckon. And, you know, he'd give the money to the kids that picked up, and he'd keep a bit himself, I suppose, and whatever. He did that for a lot of years, I know. Because, you know, to make a living off the land was hard. It was hard, you know. Sheep had a lot of... They were mainly sheep farms. They tried to grow a bit of crop, but, you know, most of the crop that they grew was fed back to the horses anyway. So, you know, that... It was a vicious circle. The only thing that they produced to sell off would be wool and old sheep sort of thing. And old sheep were worth nothing. The fat on them were worth more than what the meat was sort of thing. Because they didn't have refrigeration, so, you know, that sort of thing was useless.
What did they use the fat for?
Oh, making candles and soap and all sorts of things like that.
And that was all done at home, wasn't it?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty well, yeah. Yep. They'd make tallow candles. They wouldn't last long. Mm. Just out of the sheep fat, melted down and... Put him in a candle mould with a wick in it. I think they get one night out of a candle or something.
How many acres was Brooklands back then?
220. In the original bit. Then he got another 70 acres. And then he got another 60 and a 40 and a... I'm not sure. I can't remember. I should know. Another 100 and something acres on top of that 290, yeah. It was never a very big property because the land all around was owned by... big guys, and they couldn't get more. They couldn't expand. They was landlocked. They couldn't get out any further, and so they were stuck with what they do and what they could do off the farm type of thing. And his thing was this rabbit cart, amongst other things. Yeah,
and rabbits were a huge problem, weren't they, at the
time? Oh, absolutely. They were in plague proportions.
Now, Brooklands is situated in the Wallaroo Parish of the district, whereas Parkwood we probably call the Wetangra area.
Wetangra or Ginandera or what?
Yeah. So was Richard also a religious person?
Well, listen, it all rubbed off on all Thomas's children. It'd have to. I don't think the children like Richard, for example, faith was as strong as what Thomas's was, but they certainly had a Christian faith. There's no question about that. You know, they were clean living people. They were church going people. They were God fearing people, and they went to a lot of lengths to live cleanly, sort of thing, live properly.
So was Richard involved with the Wattle Park Church?
Absolutely.
Mm.
He was one. He would have been one of the ones that helped build it. It was in 1882. Opened in 1882. Remember, that was the year he got married. See? So he's only a young fella. But he would have contributed, of course he would have done, yeah, absolutely. Like they all would have contributed to it. Because Thomas built the church at Parkwood in 1880, which was only 2 years before. So he died soon after that, and that church never got used much. Once he died, and see, a lot of the family had moved away, and a lot of them had come to this Wallaroo and Hall area and Spring Range and that sort of area, and they needed a church up this end of the town, up into this end of the country. And so, you know, it was only a couple of years later they built Wattle Park Church, and it's you know, been thriving ever since. Where Parkwood Church basically it didn't fail, but you know, it wasn't used much because Thomas had died and he was the mainstay, and so it was never used much.
When was the Wetangra Church built? Next to the cemetery?
I think it was 1877, I think. Don't quote me though. It's on a plaque we took back one day. 1877, I think. I'm not sure. Don't quote me on it.
We can check.
Yeah, we can check. It was only a slab church, though.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a pretty rickety sort of a slab church, and it was actually moved from down near where Lynham is today in Canberra, somewhere down there on the Holy Ass Road, and they moved it. So it was never a very permanent sort of a structure.
But it's interesting, the cemetery that's adjacent to where the church was, that's where Thomas and Mary are buried.
Yeah, he was, of course, one of the ones that helped establish that church as well as his own. But the Wetangra one was more of a central area where a lot more people were. Parkwood was sort of down towards the river where the country was a lot rougher, and so there wasn't many people down there, where they sort of all lived around this Ginderra Creek and all that sort of thing a bit more and into that Wetangra area. But he was one of the main ones, and there's 2 acres or something of land there that would have belonged to the Methodist Church for years, and then it eventually, you know, the Uniting Church took it over. And it was apparently the last bit of freehold land in the ACT to be converted from leasehold to freehold. And the Uniting Church got a bit of money out of it, but it still sits there today. The land's there, I think it's 2 acres or thereabouts. The church was on 1 acre piece, and the cemetery was 1 acre. And Thomas apparently went along and sort of measured, got a centre of it all, and put his heel in the ground and said, bury me here in the middle of it. And that's where they buried him, right in the middle of the cemetery portion of it, and Mary's wife next to him.
From your mother, and she's a noted, not only family historian, but a local historian for the Canberra region. Did she talk much about your grandmother, Amelia?
No, not much about Amelia. Only, yeah, they used to call them Dick and Millie, Richard and Amelia, but they were Dick and Millie always, you know, Uncle Dick and Auntie Millie, I suppose, or whatever.
Right.
No, she talked more about her mother.
Right.
My mother and her mother, my grandmother, her mother Beatrice, had a very close relationship, apparently. You know, it was a loving, caring relationship with these two women. That you don't apparently see all that often, sort of thing, with mother and daughter, but this one it was. But no, so apart from just a bit of general stuff, no, she didn't talk much about him, really. But she, I'm sure she had every respect for her. She was quite a lovely lady, apparently. Only a small lady, you know, had all these children, and she was a bit sickly. She had a hydatid operation, I know, not long before she died in Sydney, which would have been a traumatic experience then. Lost 3 children, you know, as infants, and life was tough.
Very sad.
Mm.
All right, we'll move on to your father, Cedric. Now, Cedric inherited Brooklands from Richard.
No, he paid for some of it.
Did he?
He paid for some of it, yeah. Mm. The Brooklands bit he might have inherited, the 220 acres, but the rest of it, I know he paid some money for it. Yeah.
What was the farm like when he took it over? Quite a viable farm?
Well, see, Richard died in 19... 33, so he wouldn't have officially taken it over till then. He would have been, like a lot of us, worked it for their father. But no, Dad got land down the Murrumbidgee River. He got 900 and something acres down there. And he bought that in 1923 when he was a youngster. He's only 23 or something at the time. So it wasn't bad. I don't know where he got the money from. I mean, he obviously borrowed some of it, but yeah, he'd have to have some sort of deposit. He must have made a bit trapping rabbits, and we used to grow vegetables and sell pumpkins and all sorts of things. But no, he had land down there, and which is only 2 or 3 miles away from here. He had a little hut down there. He camped there sometimes for the night, but mostly he'd come back here. So that was his land from he sold that in about 1950 or something, because some of this land around Brooklands became available for sale, and so he jumped in quick on that. So he had that land down there, and he worked it for his father as well. So yeah, it was productive land. But one of the things he always used to say was, he bought 700 and something sheep to put on it, and in that year he lost like half of them or something. He used to quote the figures. He lost a large proportion of them to liver fluke and black disease, which is a terrible thing that sheep get. We can control it nowadays. We've got vaccines and all sorts of things for it now. But back then, they didn't have much, and the sheep just up and died. It affected their liver, and they just up and died. There's nothing much they could do. They drenched them with something, but it didn't work half the time. Once they got vaccines for black disease, it's one of these like diseases that sheep get. Once they got on top of that, yeah, it was right. So he had it tough too. But anyway.
He was a religious person too, a strong Methodist?
Yeah, absolutely, yes. Yeah, yeah. Didn't talk a lot about his faith, but he was, yeah. Yeah, you could sense it. You knew it was there. Teetotaler and, you know, clean living guy. Did work for the community, a lot of work for the community. And
what sort of work?
He had 44 years on the Yarralumla Shire Council, for example. Now, that to me is a lifetime of punishment. But
yeah.
He was Shire President for a couple of terms, I think, back in the early 50s. He had, I don't know how many years, as a director on the Yass Pasture Protection Board. He was all involved with a Canberra show. He'd all had lifetime involvement there. Of course, involved with the church. Was one of the ones that started the Wallaroo Bush Fire Brigade, for example, and had a long involvement with Bush Fire Brigades in their early days where they didn't have any equipment much. But somebody had to start, and he was one of them, along with a couple of others. Oh, he did a lot of other things for the community, you know, more than I can remember. He used to run Marina Year competitions there in the 60s, I remember. All sort of, you know, farm-related things, but good competition in the district. You don't see that anymore.
When, of course, you're talking about the Canberra show, it would have been the Hall show.
Oh, yeah, originally, yeah. Yeah.
But he was
involved. Yeah, but he was involved when it went to Canberra, of course. He stayed there for a long time. He was a sheep steward and all sorts of things he did in the show.
You mentioned his time on the Yarralumla Shire Council, which is, pretty valuable.
Well, he took over. He had to be elected, of course, from his father. Richard had spent 16 years, I think it was, as a councillor, an elected councillor, and then when he dropped out long before he died, I think, Dad then stood and had to be voted, elected, of course, and got himself very well respected in that Yarralumla Council. They had the staff and that in there had a lot of time for him. I used to go in there with him occasionally and had a lot of respect for Dad. He did a lot. He didn't think, everybody said, all these councillors, they tar their own road and all this thing. But Dad wasn't like that. He did a lot for this local area, because we were out here in Yarralumla Shire. I was then based in Queanbeyan, so you had Canberra in between, and this was a sort of a dead end thing out here, and he used to fight for this area, yes, but not for his own road type of thing. But, yeah.
That's an interesting point that you touch on. What was the impact on the farm, on your family, when Canberra started to grow? And, as we sit here at Brooklands and look over, we can see suburbs of Canberra, not that far away.
Yeah, well, apparently they, both my mother and father, I think, went to the naming of Canberra in 1913. So, they watched it grow right from day one. If they weren't there, they weren't far away, or they went to an opening old Parliament House and all those things. They'd go to that sort of thing. And so, they watched it grow, so it sort of, they grew with it. This sort of the area we look at across the Belconnen and that now, that was only established in the 70s. And by then, Mum and Dad were sort of winding down. But it was there, and it's it's totally, but Canberra, the offshoot from Canberra is that all this land in New South Wales, this freehold land, has all been subdivided now up into hobby farm type thing. There's no genuine farmers at Wallaroo anymore. It's all been subdivided. Some of them think they're farmers, but they're not really.
Your mother and father, did they both go to Hall School?
Yes. Mum was in the first intake in 1911 when it started, and she did all her education there, apart from, I think, 1 year at MLC in Sydney, at Burwood in Sydney. Dad went started at this Brookland school, and he stayed here till the end of 1911 when it closed. Then he had to ride a horse to Hall, because he was the only one left here of that age to still go to school. So he rode a horse to school at Hall until he finished his education.
That's another interesting point, that the Brookland school was on the Brooklands property.
Yeah, well, apparently there was a lot of children in 1882 when Richard got married, so he didn't have children, but there was a demand for a school. And with a bit of local discussion, they decided that where the Brookland site is, which was then the Wallaroo school, was the best central sort of a spot to have it. And that the parents built it, apparently, as a provisional school, and it outgrew that, and by 1895 or something, they built a proper school, you know, public school, a Department of Education funded thing. And the teacher, it was always one teacher school, and the teacher had to board with the parents around the place. And yeah, and it went till the end of 1911, and then, as I said, the children were all gone, and it was all over.
As an aside, I understand Sarah Gordon, who was one of the teachers, eventually married a Southwell.
Yeah, well, that was inevitable, wasn't it? Yeah, these female teachers coming out of Sydney and all sorts of places, sent you out of the bush. I reckon 90% of them would have married a local farmer's son or something. That's the way it is. Fair enough.
Your mother, Beryl, is from the Kilby side of the family.
Yeah.
We have spoken to Wes Kilby and Bessie Bardwell, who are descendants from that same family. Now, Beryl's parents were James Kilby and Beatrice Kilby. You mentioned before that she was very close to her mother, Beatrice.
Yep.
Were they still around when you were young?
James, yeah, grandmother died in 1947, so, you know, so I was only 4 or 5. I can remember when she died, though.
Mm.
I can just remember it sort of thing. I remember going up there in the car, me and my two sisters were in the back, and my mother was crying, and I sort of couldn't cope with that. I thought, why does my mother cry? Only children cry, you know, your mother doesn't cry. And she was crying, because I mean, I don't know if I was going to a funeral, whether it was the day, I don't know. It was a pretty sad time for her, I do know that.
Yeah. They lived at the Falls.
Originally, yeah.
Yeah. And that was burnt out in the bushfires of 1905.
The property was. The house wasn't. They saved, they saved the house, I think, with a bucket of pig slops or something, so the story goes.
Mm.
So I think they saved the house, or most of it, pretty well, but the property was burnt. Most of the stock would have been burnt.
But they then moved to Enna Hill at Hall.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the fire was only part of it. I mean, they had, you know, three or four children before that. And, you know, they were of age to go to school, and there was no school down there, down the back box of Jindera Creek. And so James decided he'd better go to where there was a school to get his children educated. And so he went up there, the older children went to Jindera School, of course, and then when Hall opened, they went to Hall.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned before your mother, Beryl, was a very active family historian and also did a lot of work with the Canberra District Historical Society. She contributed, I believe, too, to the history of the Wattle Park Church and projects like that.
Well, I had a lifetime at Wattle Park, yeah. Did all the things that you did, got involved in all the things, worked hard for it, which is what was the thing to do, I guess. And yeah, she was keen on the historical side. She was one of the founding members of it, I believe. Was very involved with Blundell's Cottage and all that sort of thing. Used to organise excursions out to properties and all sorts of things. And yeah. She was involved in that. That was her thing, history and stuff. And a home and a family, of course. They came first. But, you know, as the family grew up and there wasn't as much demand on the sort of thing, she got more involved in this history sort of thing. It was her thing.
With the Wattle Park Church, there was a lot of activities going on there. There was Sunday school, there was Band of Hope, there was all sorts of little sub-organisations. Were you a member of any of those?
Yep, I was. I went to Sunday school from when day one almost, because I had two older sisters. They went, so I had to go. I mean, I was only a baby. But, you know, I eventually ended up going to the Sunday school. I went to Sunday school until I was about 21, I think. We had a good teacher thing, and there was six or eight of us. We had these Bible study groups, and we got on well. It was good.
Who was the teacher?
Stan Nowlan.
Mm-hmm.
He was a guy that worked on a property and then ended up managing it and so forth. He's gone from his area now, but he was a good, honest guy and did a lot of good. And then soon after I left there, I ended up going back as an assistant teacher. I think it overlapped a bit. Sometimes I'd be an assistant teacher somewhere, and probably out in the kindergarten or something like that. I wasn't doing much, but I was there. And then I've had a lifetime of it. I've been going there ever since. Like the Wattle Park Sunday School, for example, has only had four superintendents, which is the person that sort of runs it. The first one was old Samuel, and then there was Samson South, or like Samson's son Sam at Wattle Park. Then there was Dad, Cedric. Then there was, no, it was five. There was Thelma, and then me.
Hmm.
And under my tenure, it basically collapsed. But I don't think I can take the blame for it. I think kids don't go to Sunday school anymore. We tried to get them there, and eventually it wound up. They still try and run a thing up there now, but there's only one kid goes half the time. So I don't think you can really count it now. But yeah, I had a life involvement in that. This Band of Hope was one of these so-called temperance things, but we didn't promote that part of it much. It was an excuse to have a good time. We used to put on concert things a couple of times a year, maybe. You know, a bit of simple play acting stuff, and anybody who could play a musical instrument or sing or something, get up and do something. And we'd have a couple of social nights up there at the hall of the church and that sort of thing. Yeah.
When your father passed on, you inherited Brooklands. Is that correct?
No. It went to my mother.
Right.
She inherited when he died, and then I inherited after that from my mother when she died in 1988.
And you've spent the last how many years on the farm?
All my life. Never lived anywhere else.
70 years? 71?
71 years, yeah.
Right.
I had 4 years of boarding school.
Well, we'll get on to schools in a moment.
All that good, that didn't mean anyway.
So,
when I left school at 16, I started work on the farm.
Mm.
And that's been basically the only work I've ever done. I went and did wool classing, and so I used to go away wool classing a bit, just to, as a break, to do something different in life.
Mm.
And I drove a dump truck down the river for a sand wash gravel crushing place there for a good while, as a bit of a sideline thing, just for a bit of fun, bit of money, but it was dangerous work. I should have never done it. Anyway, I used to run the polling booth up here for the election. Those three things were the only things I think I ever got, only other paid work I ever did, apart from working on the farm.
Mm-hmm. The farm, I mean, it's looking beautiful at the moment. We've had a good shower of rain and everything's looking green and lush. You're obviously proud of the place, and you've put a lot of time and effort into it. Do you have any stories that you'd like to share about life on the farm? Things like, you know, we've talked in the past about the shearers' dances and the running races with the shearers and all sorts of activities that you would organise?
Yeah, that's something Cynthia and I sort of organised here in through the 80s mainly. We had these shearers that come from Condobra, and there's a lot of young fellas that came down here and had never seen the lights of a big city. And if they, we often thought if they get in there, I'll run amok. And so we thought, we'll keep them at home. And so we decided to put on a bit of entertainment for them. And so on a Saturday night, we put on a woolshed dance. And they, of course, all the shearers were invited. And anybody who ever worked on the property during the year for any reason at all was invited. And we could invite as many females as we could get here, of course, because there wasn't many here. So we'd bring all the girls we could get. And we'd have a dance. We'd get a band. We were in the Country Music Association then, and we'd get a little band out here. couple of young fellas with guitars and some drums and stuff, and have a wool shed dance. And then on the Sunday we'd run a foot race. It seems to took a lot of preparation, a lot of cheating and a lot of fun. It's all just simple fun, that's what it was. For that, yeah.
There were many years where, you know, you were drought affected and the farm wasn't as productive as it could be. How did you manage?
You just had to keep going. I can remember those droughts in the 60s. Now, I was still young then, and I seemed to spend all my time cutting water to sheep and cattle. We had creeks here that I could pump out of with a tractor and a 500-gallon tank on a trailer thing. Do that all day. Cut it up and dump it in a dam, go back and get another load. You did it all day, non-stop. I mean, it'd take about 10 or 20 minutes to fill the tank, so you'd have your lunch while you're doing that, and you'd go again, and you just went all day. But after a while with droughts, I believe you get cunning. And a lot of farmers don't do it, and I reckon that's wrong. My father did it before, he taught me, basically, but I modified it a bit. I used to grow crops in, not to sell, but I'd put in an oat crop every year, and we used to lamb in May, and you'd put them on that green crop, get the crop in early, the right variety of oats, and get it in early in February or March, and by the time it's time to wean the lambs in June, the ewes were finished lambing, you could put them on this oat, green feed in the wintertime, because it was a bulk of feed then, it was good feed, and that would feed them all through the winter. Then you'd shut it up about the end of August and either make hay out of it in November or harvest the crop in Christmas time and put that away. So I used to have the silos, I used to fill the silos with oats, hay shed full of hay, and feed it back out in a drought. And I did that all the time, every year I did that. Only a couple of years did it ever really fail, the crop actually failed and I got nothing out of it. But I pretty well always had something else. There's only about twice I ever bought feed, and then I only bought it because I panicked, I think. I didn't really need to do it. So, I was sort of looking after myself like that. And I reckon that's the way to survive. When now people think, we've got to go and buy feed. As soon as the paddock looks a bit dry, you've got to rush out and buy feed. And you pay a lot of money for it. And it keeps the stock alive, but yeah.
You have related the story to me in the past about you had a visiting archbishop come and you had to shoot 300 sheep.
Back in 1991, I think it was, in Canberra they had the World Council of Churches conference where all these big-time church people came to Canberra for this conference. And I was teaching Sunday school at Wattle Park and we had the kids singing along. And next minute, any of the people were here, sort of thing, but I didn't realise it at Wattle Park. Yes, I'm sorry, I did, because he'd spoken at the church, but he walked in the door of the Sunday school, not quite unexpected, and here was this great big black shiny man with this big red cape on. And we had to entertain him for a little while, and that was all right. Anyway, we invited him home afterwards. He was interested. He was interested to learn all he could about farming in Australia and everything else, so I invited him home. And I got a 1961 Cadillac, and I remember I took him for a ride in his Cadillac, and he thought that was pretty good. But we got talking, and that week I was going to shoot a heap of sheep. I ended up shooting 435 sheep in one go, put them in a big hole in the ground. That takes a fair bit of doing. But I told him about that, and he was the Bishop of Nigeria, that's right. And he had all these starving people, and he cried when I told him I was going to shoot all these sheep. I said, it was good meat, you could eat it. He cried, and I said, well, you can have them. I'll give them to you. They're yours. You take them away. I said, it's going to cost me money to shoot them. And he cried to think he had all these starving people in his country, and here was all this meat, all this food. What could we do? I couldn't do anything with it. I then went on and suggested to him that his people should practice a bit more birth control, but anyway, I think that went over real well. But anyway, I said, you're better off with a plain load of the pill or condoms or something, but he didn't like that.
All right, we touched on your early life before. You spent time at a boarding school in Orange. Prior to that, you did go to Hall School. And I know that's been subject to another interview, which was the Voices of the Past series done in 1990, I think it was, by their children at Hall School. But just to give us a short summary of your life at Hall School, what are the highlights and the lowlights?
The day I turned six in November 1948, I think I went to Hall School for the first time. It was the day after, I don't know. So I started there at the end of 48. Why my mother sent me at the end of the year, I don't know, but it seemed like a good idea. And I went there to Leninong in 54, when Dick O'Sullivan was the teacher, one teacher school, in the old building up there. We learnt to read and write, yeah. You learnt to the tune of a hickory stick, as they say. You know, if you got it wrong, you got yourself into strife. But we learnt to read and write. We learnt... I mean, in some ways he was a shocking man. I could tell you some terrible stories, but I won't. But hey, we learnt. We learnt. We had to learn. And we learnt. He'd have a couple of hours in a day when he could teach you. And you learnt. You had to. And I know when I went to boarding school, to high school, yeah, I know some of the teachers said, you know, could see that I could do the work. I mean, didn't happen like that all the way through, but yeah, but so we basically had an education up there, such as it were.
Well, apart from the education, what was school life like? You know, how did you, you know, what was the school like back in the 50s?
When you hear about what kids do now at school and how much they're supervised and all this sort of thing, you know, we had none of that. You know, playtime and lunchtime, there was absolutely no supervision. You could do what you like. You went where you liked. But if you got into strife, you copped it. So you knew you didn't play up too much. But, you know, you had free run of the school ground. You'd play games. You could do whatever you like. You couldn't leave the ground, but then why would you want to? No point. So, you know, we made our own fun.
The facilities were pretty basic, weren't they? You had a weather shed to have your lunch in case
it rained.
Yeah, if it rained,
but mostly we'd sit outside. But it was raining, you'd be in the weather shed, yeah.
And basic toilets, facilities?
Yeah, they were pit toilets, I think, when I first went there. Then they got these fancy whiz-bang things that never worked. They weren't a septic tank thing. They were something of hygiene or something they'd written on them. But they were a disaster, stinking things. They were, yeah. So it was all pretty basic. But it did, like, by the time I got there, the school did have power, which we didn't have at home at the start. So that was a big thing for me, to have lights and all that sort of thing. But no heating. There's two little electric heaters next best to useless. The fireplace that's up there now was closed off. We never had a fire gun. Ever did I see that, because it was blanked off. So life was tough. It was freezing cold in the wintertime then. Stinking hot in the summer, but it was cold in the winter. That was the hard bit. And boys then all wore short pants to school, so you never had long pants at all. Didn't own a pair of long pants, I don't think, when I was a primary school kid. Then I'd ride a bike home.
Yeah.
In the cold and the rain and the wind and the whatever.
I was going to ask you how you got to school.
My parents used to drive me to... Well, I had two older sisters, remember. We'd get driven to school most of the morning because it seems to be all uphill. You ride a bike from here to Hall and it seems to be all uphill. I don't think it really is, but it appears to be. And, you know, we couldn't do it. You just couldn't do it. I mean, it could have done. I did ride my bike to school a few times, yeah. But they'd take us up then and on Tuesdays and Fridays we get a ride home on the mail run. The shop used to run a mail run, a grocery run, and your job there was to open the gates for the driver, and that, you know, there was 30 or 40 gates on that trip. So you earned your keep there. The other 3 days I'd ride the bike home as I got a bit older. Yeah.
Apart from school life then, what do you remember of growing up? I mean, you're on the property here at Brooklands, but you went into the village, you went to the movies and went to the hall.
Like primary school time you're talking about?
Yeah.
That sort of thing, yeah.
Yeah.
Apart from school, church, Sunday school, I used to ride my bike to hall on Saturday afternoon sometime just to meet up with a mate of mine and we'd do something together. Because, you know, I was down here on my own. Boy on my own, you know.
Who was your mate?
Harvey Brown was my mate. He's my cousin. He and I were good mates. Did a lot of things together. Even as adults, we did a lot together. Yeah, as young adults sort of thing. We used to go on holidays and all that sort of thing.
What was Hall like then, in those days?
Hall was totally different to what it is now, because it was a sort of a temporary dormitory thing for Canberra. There was older houses up there and things. People were living in, you know, migrants came out here after the war and they had to have somewhere to live, and they'd live anywhere after what they'd been through. They'd put up with anything. And it was a transient population living in all these old houses and half-fallen down places. Until, you know, then it was, late 60s or 70s, and, you know, all changed totally when the freehold thing changed and all that. So you went up there and made your own fun. You know, we did, played around, whatever. Didn't get up to too much mischief.
I get the sense, though, that Hall was quite a community. I mean, you had the Hall show, you had the Hall, for want of a better word, where you had the dances and...
Yeah, we used to run them. Like, that was after I left school, though.
Yeah.
We used to run dances in where the antique shop is now. Did that for years, yeah.
Well, you went to boarding school then, just going through the timeline. You went to boarding school after Hall School at Orange.
Yep.
For 4 years, was it?
Yep.
And that finished off your education, and then you came back to work on the farm.
Yep. I went to Tech and did wool classing. That was the only further education I did.
Right. And that you slotted straight into the farm life? You enjoyed it? And
yeah, it's a big change, though, it was. You know, you're at a boarding school with 100 other, or whatever, 100 other boys. Yeah, and so you're with people all the time. Yeah, you know, of your own age sort of thing. You had friends and enemies and all the things that you do at boarding school. And all of a sudden it's all over. When you come home to a farm, you've got to... The only person you mix with, like as far as during the day, was your father and your mother, yeah. But, you know, so Dad and I had to get on, didn't we? And we didn't always get on. Clashed a couple of times, but we basically got on. But, you know, it was sort of lonely life for a good while.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're straight into work, straight into it, you know. You had to learn quick and expected to do all this sort of stuff. And it was, you know, you work long days and work hard and, yeah, but we survived.
Time off was your entertainment, was going to Hall, meet Harvey Brown and...
Yeah, that'd be like a Saturday afternoon, if nothing else. You know, I'd work Saturday morning and go to church on Sunday.
Yeah.
And wash the car or something.
Yeah. And you did this for many, many years. But you're also involved in the community. I mean, you're involved with the Methodist Church, you're involved with the Wallaroo Fire Brigade, you're involved with the Rotary Club of Hall.
Yeah, that was all later, of course.
Hmm.
I mean, church was the main thing you were involved in, like, as a regular thing. Well, after we left school, we started this thing called the Monomyth Club in Hall.
Right.
Which was just a youth group, for want of a better thing. No connection with anything else, not a church thing, nothing to do with anybody else. We just started it off, because there's a heap of teenagers up there. We're all sort of within 4 or 5 years of each other, and we're all, most of us, you know, involved in Wattle Park anyway. But we just wanted to do things, and we did. We formed this club, and we had a president, secretary and all this sort of thing. And we used to run dances up here every now and again for a charity. We'd nominate a charity. Sometimes the dances were a disaster and nobody would come. But sometimes they did and we'd give a bit of money away. We'd organise a bus trip or two every year. We got the snow every year. We'd go to somewhere down the coast or somewhere else every year, to caves or something every year in a bus, charter a bus. And we'd have a meeting once a month and we'd just have a good time.
How many members were in the Monomyth Club?
Oh, gee.
Because you used to meet in the old Hall School, didn't you?
No, we meet in somebody's house.
Oh, okay.
Always in somebody's house. Oh, I don't know, it'd vary a bit. There might be 10 or a dozen or 15.
Mm.
Yeah, not a lot. They'd come and go a bit. And then we all sort of got married and moved away and whatever, and it all fell over. I mean, it did its job at the time.
Mm. Yeah. So your family have grown up on this property as well, and now they're making their own way?
My children, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had a first marriage that didn't work from 67 to 76 or whatever. Yeah, and I got 2 children from that marriage. Then I had a couple of years on my own, and then I married Cynthia with her 2 children. We set up a house here.
Now, you both are very involved, or you have been involved, and I'll go back to what I was saying before with the Wallaroo community. I mean, you were both extremely active in the Wallaroo Fire Brigade.
Somebody had to do it.
Yeah.
If you own land, it was the decent thing to do was to be involved in that sort of thing, because somebody's got to do it, in other words. So we did it. I mean, I got involved in it as soon as I left school, in some form or other. It wasn't a terribly organised group then. It was just a bit of a free-for-all, but when the fire started, you all went and fought the fire. Eventually they started to delegate job sort of thing, and all the firefighting units were on private trucks, and it was all a bit mismatched, but anyway, it worked reasonably well. Eventually, you know, it became more structured and we got proper trucks allocated and all this sort of thing, and we had one here for, I don't know, 20 years, was it, really? I don't know. I used to drive that. Cynthia was my crew. I trained her up because she didn't, you know, she used to say, I'd go to a fire soon after I'm married. She'd ask me when I got home, were you a crew? I said, oh, I'd pick up somebody along the way. And you work it out as you went along. And she decided she'd better learn to do it. So we I trained her up a bit. We made the best crew in the district. I don't care what anyone says. We used to get there, if it was, the fire was anywhere in this area, we were there first. We had a smallish truck that would go, and I'd flog it along pretty well, and we'd put it anywhere, four-wheel drive thing, and it'd go anywhere. We put out a lot of fires before the other people even got there.
What was the worst fire you ever had to fight?
Oh, dear me.
Were you involved in that big fire? Or?
1979 was a shocker, that one that started Hall and went through to Gunneroo Road somewhere, or the highway, I think. My truck broke down, though, and I got up way up a hill there somewhere in the middle of the night and did a universal joint, and we had all sorts of strife. But we were able to get another one and get it in for the next day. Excuse me. And we got it going again. That was a shocking, but I was certainly involved in it, and close to some of it. It was such a horrific wind. But then there was another one I went to at Wombine, that was where I was in, these pine trees had just exploded. And another one at Park we were in, it wasn't so horrific, the fire, but we got stuck in this smoke and you couldn't see a damn thing. But no, I don't think my life was ever in danger, that I couldn't get out of it now somewhere or other.
I know you're not one to blow your own trumpet, but I understand you have received some acknowledgement formally for all the work that you've done.
Well, Cynthia and I got the national medal here a few years ago. I got 3 bars on mine for 40 years of service or something. She's got one for 15 or something. But you do that to him. If you're going to live in a community, you've got to be involved in it.
Yeah, that's it's a very big thing with a farming community, isn't it?
Mm.
What about the Rotary Club of Hall? You were one of the charter...
Yep.
...or the founders of...
Yeah, charter member. There's 6 of us left. We're a great bunch, doing a lot of good in the world.
When it was established in the late 80s, I believe?
89, yeah, November 89.
Yeah. What was the idea? What was it, just a group thinking it'd be a good idea to set up a Rotary Club, or...?
No, but Rotary's got its own identity sort of thing. It's got its own rules and regulations to a point. I mean, every club is autonomous, what's the word? Yeah, every club is on its own sort of thing, but
yeah,
there's Rotary guidelines that you sort of follow. And what it was, the one guy in Hall that was in Belconnen Rotary Club that had a business in Hall and decided Hall was a good place to start a club. Because there was a lot of guys here that they thought were suitable. It was men only at that stage. A lot of guys here that were suitable. And he worked on it for a while, along with a few others in Belconnen Club, and we got Hall off the ground. And you had to have 25 members then to start. We got our 25, but 2 or 3 of them never showed up much. But anyway, we got going. We were 18, 19 members there for a while. I was president in 91, 92, second president. We learned a lot fast about Rotary and how to work it. But that was all good fun. And so it goes on, we're going from strength to strength and giving away hundreds of thousands of dollars now.
You're also a trustee of Weetangaroo Cemetery?
Yes, I am. It's a pretty loose term now, but yes, I am. Yeah, whatever that just means. We're there to care for it a bit, you know. We go over there occasionally and have a bit of a clean-up and mow the grass a bit and whatever. Do a bit of maintenance on some of the graves. Try and hopefully the vandals don't get in there too much. It's had a lot of vandal damage over the years, but it seems to be a bit better now.
Was your mother a trustee at the Hall Cemetery?
No.
I just see her photo on the heritage board there.
Yeah, that's because of the family history thing. No, she wasn't. The Hall Cemetery, I don't think, hadn't really had trustees. It had somebody kept a book, one of the Kilbys kept a book, and, you know, if you wanted to be buried there, you put your name in the book, and that was about it.
Right.
nothing was too structured with it, I don't think. I don't know whether it was sort of surveyed as such or how it worked. But then when the ACT Cemetery Trust took it all over, of course, different thing altogether now.
Yeah. What other roles have you taken on in your life as far as community activities? You've done a lot for the church. You've done a lot with the Fire Brigade.
I was a Sunday school teacher for years. I was on the property committee up there at the church for years. I mean, I've been involved in that all the way through, whatever. I've been, in the Bush Fire Brigade. I was secretary treasurer for years and years and years. I got to be senior captain there. I mean, I was offered the captain's job, but I declined. I got involved with the show. I've had, on and off years involvement with the Canberra show, but I'm not involved anymore. I ran the wool section and built that up from nothing. The old guy that was running it before me was getting old and worn out, tired, and I built that up from next to nothing up to quite a decent show. But they took that off me and gave it to somebody else. It's never been the same since, in my opinion. But we used to run a thing called Farm World, and that was a good education program. I enjoyed that. But I'm not involved in that anymore. I was on the board of the Historical Society for years. Wasn't really my thing mixing with the public servants, but I experienced it. It was something I experienced. I actually was the chairman or convener or whatever it was of the Bundle Farmhouse Committee for years. I was heavily involved in that for years, but when the government sort of took that over, and the Historical Society didn't want it, the government took it back, I said, I'm not going to be a volunteer for the ACT government, so I dropped out of that. I don't know, I've been involved in other things. I was a director on the Yass PP board for 11 years. When my father got too old for that, I got elected to that, and got elected to it a few times, but then I...
PP meaning the Pastoral Protection Board.
Pastoral Protection Board it was then. It's since changed its name a couple of times, and it's almost non-existent now, but anyway. It was a thing sort of under the direction of the New South Wales Department of Agriculture, where it was administering like grants and earmarks sort of thing, looking after travelling stock reserves, and we had a vet, in-house vet there to look after, you know, commercial stock, that sort of thing there. But it, you know, it's finished up now. It's
now
somebody else.
You have an important role nowadays that you're one of the wonderful volunteer friends of Hall School Museum. You've taken on that role very well.
Oh, you think so?
I do. You've been very generous in loaning some of the items that you have here at the farm for our displays and exhibitions, and also you're fortunate to have a wealth of your mother's historical material here that we've been able to borrow and copy. And I think without that we would have some very, very strong gaps in our... Yeah, historical side and the cultural heritage of Hall.
Yeah, I keep finding more of my mother's stuff. I don't know where I'll find it, but I unearth another box and find something interesting. Perhaps I've seen it before but hadn't realised it was there or whatever, yeah.
Yeah.
But that, yeah, all right, I've been involved with that. But my theory in life is if you've got this stuff, there's no point sticking it in a box in the wardrobe, is it? If you've got it, flaunt it. That's what I reckon. If you've got it and people are interested in looking at it, let them look at it. Let them experience it.
Well, that sounds like a wonderful note on which to end this little chat. So thank you, Kingsley, for your time. And is there anything you'd like to add?
Thanks, Phil.
Okay.